Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Matters, the show in which I discuss all matters of the mind and in which I show how much mind matters. Welcome to part 10 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Udo Staatsbuchler and I am live on air and I welcome your calls with questions and comments as long as they relate to the subject I'm talking about. All other questions, comments, and suggestions I will answer by email. Just go to my website http://www.mindmattersonline.info. Find my email address and write to me. Mind Matters Online is one word. I will reply within 48 hours. On page 4 of my website, you will find recordings of all my previous radio programs for you to listen to at your leisure. For newcomers to the show, I also repeat my request from the last few weeks and ask you again to go to the blogtalkradio.com website and click on the button at the top of the page that says Connect Using Facebook and then follow the prompts. Your Facebook friends can then share the show with us. Last week, I talked about the mind, its definition, and its purpose. Today, I'm going to continue for a while with the same theme, and then, time permitting, I will move on to the power of resilience. But first, I want to answer two questions that were asked by email. One very important one was whether my method allows everybody to control their minds to change their lives. And the second one asked for clarification of Freud's ego and it in the context of the mind. To the first one, in theory, yes, it is possible for everybody to change their mindsets and to exercise control over their lives. There are no age restrictions, there is no sex difference, and it doesn't need any university degrees. But in practice, I have come across some obstacles that made it impossible for some individuals to achieve success with my method. One of the obstacles is certain religions that have instilled the belief in the followers that the mind should not be interfered with because it is part of our psyche and psyche is in the hands of God or some other higher power. A long time ago, I have decided never to discuss religion of any kind and most certainly not to persuade people away from their beliefs. Exactly the same applies to spiritual beliefs. A similar category of people are those who choose to simply not believe that change is possible. Whatever evidence I offer, the response is, no, it's not possible. Many times, or most of the time, not even offering any reason as to why it wasn't possible. And then there are those who I call the typical patients. These are the ones who go see the doctor and say, Doctor, I've got this problem. And then they hand over their problem to the doctor, expecting him or her to solve it. They are the ones who themselves do not contribute to their physical or mental well-being in any which way, other than by saying, Doctor, I've got this problem. Deal with it. It's yours now. They are also the ones who come to see me believing that I can change the mindsets for them without any effort on their own part. Well, I just cannot do that. I have no silver bullet, no magic potion, and no magic wand that I can wave and say something like abracadabra and lo and behold, all is well. Believe it or not, many years ago a woman came to see me and she thought that I had a machine with which I could cure her of an anxiety disorder she thought she had. She was terribly disappointed and upset when I had to tell her that such a machine doesn't exist. So, these are the categories of people who in general cannot take control over their minds. There might be others, but I cannot remember having come across them. But everybody else can take control over their minds. Everybody else can change their lives. Everybody else can determine their destinies. The second question was about id, ego, and superego. One of Sigmund Freud's most important proposals was that the human psyche has more than one aspect, namely the id, ego, and superego, all developing at different stages in our lives. But note that these are systems, not parts of the brain or in any way physical. The it is Latin and means it, I-T, third person singular, and it consists of all the inherited, such as the biological components of personality, including the sex instinct, eros, which contains the libido, and aggressive instinct, the death instinct, it could also be thanatos. The it is the impulsive and unconscious part of our psyche, which responds directly and immediately to the instincts. The personality of a newborn child is all it, and only later does it develop ego and superego. The it demands immediate satisfaction, and when this happens, we experience pleasure. When it is denied, we experience pain. The it has nothing in common with reality, logic, or the everyday world, but it operates on the pleasure principle, which is the idea that every wishful impulse should be satisfied immediately, regardless of the consequences. The crying newborn baby wants to be taken care of now, immediately. You just cannot use logic to convince the baby to wait until you are at home. By the way, the pleasure principle that I mentioned is also something Sigmund Freud wrote about in detail in an essay in 1920. The ego is also Latin and means I, first person singular. And Sigmund Freud wrote in 1923, and I quote, "That part of the it which has been modified by the direct influence of the external world," unquote. The ego is developed to mediate between the totally unrealistic it and the external real world. Ideally, the ego uses reason, whereas the it is chaotic and unreasonable. The ego operates according to the reality principle, which was also proposed by Sigmund Freud. It compels people to defer immediate gratification when necessary due to obstacles of reality. For example, a person with a high sex drive must learn to control his or her impulses. It would be firstly impractical and secondly socially unacceptable to have sex every time he or she felt like it. But the it also seeks pleasure and avoids pain. However, unlike the it, the ego is concerned with devising a realistic strategy to obtain pleasure. The ego has no concept of right or wrong. Something is good simply if it achieves its end of satisfying without causing harm to itself or to the it. The superego, it means the above ego, the above I. The superego incorporates the values and morals of society, which are learned from one's parents and other people who can influence a child's educational development. It develops around the age of 4 to 5 years old. The superego's function is to control the impulses of the it, especially those which society forbids. It has also the function of persuading the ego to turn to moralistic goals rather than to those that are simply realistic ones, and it persuades the ego to strive for perfection. The superego consists of two systems, the conscience and the ideal self. The conscience can punish the ego through causing feelings of guilt. For example, if the ego gives in to its demands, the superego may make the person feel bad through guilt. The ideal self is an imaginary picture of how you ought to be and represents career aspirations, how to treat other people, and how to behave as a member of society. Behavior which falls short of the ideal self may be punished by the superego through guilt. The superego can also reward us when we behave properly by making us feel proud or making us feel good. If a person, however, a person's ideal self is too high a standard, then whatever the person does will represent failure. The ideal self and conscience are largely determined in childhood from parental values and how you were brought up. Unfortunately, this is an area which had messed up many of my clients. According to Freud, mind and psyche are the same. Some people agree with this, others do not. I do. Because, as I also said in last week's show, it works for me and the work I do, and that is a good enough proof for me. In last week's talk, I said that also according to Freud, the mind is like an iceberg and only 10% of it is occupied by our conscious mind. Located in the unconscious mind is it. Superego is in the preconscious aspect of mind, and ego floats in all aspects, the conscious, the subconscious, and the unconscious mind. How does this knowledge affect your ability to take control over your life? Well, I'm sure that some of you will not be affected by it at all by it, but others it will help to know as much as possible about the theory and the science behind my method. One aspect of the unconscious mind I did not address in my last talk, for no reason other than I could not fit it into the 45 minutes available to me. So let us now talk about intuition. But before I go into it, let me just repeat my message that I'm live on air, and that I welcome your calls with questions and comments concerning the subject I'm talking about. All other questions, comments, and suggestions I will answer by email. Go to my website, http://www.mindmattersonline.info, where you find my email address. MindMattersOnline is one word. The same, of course, applies also to listeners who want to call in but cannot get through to this show. Communicating directly with you is very important to me. I really want to know what you think about this show, what comments and suggestions you have, and also what problems you have. So please get in touch. On page 4 of my website, you'll find recordings of all my previous shows for you to listen to at your leisure. Now let us talk about intuition. Merriam-Webster, the medical dictionary, defines intuition as 1. Immediate apprehension or cognition without reasoning or inferring. 2. Knowledge or conviction gained by intuition. 3. The power or faculty of gaining direct knowledge or cognition without evident rational thought. I don't know about you, but I find this definition not at all satisfactory. It is just a definition and does not explain anything else about intuition. There are some synonyms for intuition, such as gut feeling, hunch, and sixth sense. They're all the same. There are some schools of thought. Some of them seek the answer in some esoteric beliefs, and others in psychology. Then there's a school of thought that says that intuition does not exist and is only parapsychological fluff. But the schools of thought that accept intuition as something that exists do have in common is that they all see that intuitive information comes without searching the conscious memory. When intuition hits us, we seem to arrive at an insight from seemingly unknown sources directly to our conscious awareness. Wham! Out of nowhere, in no time. And it manifests with that you know things. You don't even know how you know them. Yet you have a sense of certainty when driving down a strange street that you really must make a left turn or quit your job and move to the far end of the world. Intuitions or gut feelings are sudden, strong judgments whose origin we cannot immediately explain. Although they seem to emerge from an obscure inner force, they actually begin with a perception of something outside. It could be a facial expression, a tone of voice, a visual inconsistency, so fleeting that you are not even aware you noticed. Think of them as rapid cognition or condensed reasoning that takes advantage of the brain's built-in shortcuts. Or think of intuition as an unconscious associative process. Long dismissed as magical or beneath the dignity of science, intuition turns out to master some fancy and fast mental operations. The best explanation psychologists now offer is that intuition is a mental matching game. The brain, or rather the mind, takes in a situation, does a very quick search of its files and programs, and then finds its best match in the vast storage space of memories and knowledge. Based on that match, you ascribe meaning to the situation in front of you. For example, a doctor might simply glance at a pallid young woman complaining of fatigue and shortness of breath and immediately intuit she suffers from anemia. The gut itself literally feeds gut feelings. Think of butterflies in the stomach when a decision is pending. The gut has millions of nerve cells and through them almost a mind of its own. Still, gut feelings do not originate there, but in signals from the brain. The visceral punch in the paunch is testament that emotions are an intrinsic part of all gut feelings. I don't think that emotions and intuition can be separated. Emotion guides how we learn from experience. In particular, if you witness something while your adrenaline is pumping, for instance, it will be remembered very, very vividly. Experience is encoded in our brains as a web of fact and feeling. When a new experience calls up a similar pattern, it doesn't unleash just stored knowledge, but also an emotional state of mind and a predisposition to respond in a certain way. Imagine meeting a date who reminds you of a previous love, and you will re-experience the feelings that you had felt towards her. Your mind will now associate these feelings with your new date, and as a consequence, suddenly you begin to fall in love all over again. Intuition can be described as almost immediate situation understanding as opposed to immediate knowledge. Understanding is filled with emotion. Knowledge is not. We do not obtain knowledge of love, danger, or joy. We feel them in a meaningful way. Encased in certainty, intuitions compel us to act in specific ways, and those who lack intuition are essentially cognitively paralyzed. The psychologist Antoine Bechara at the University of Southern California studied brain-damaged patients who could not form emotional intuitions when making a decision. They were left to decide purely via deliberate reasoning. Bechara found that they ended up doing such a complicated analysis factoring everything in, that it could take them hours to decide between two kinds of cereal. While endless reasoning in the absence of guiding intuitions is unproductive, some people, including former US President Bush, champion the other extreme, going with the gut all the time. Intuition, however, is best used as a first step in solving a problem or deciding what to do. The more experience you have in a particular domain, the more reliable your intuitions, because they arise out of the richest array of collected patterns of experience. But even in your area of expertise, it is wisest to test out your hunches. You could easily have latched on to the wrong detail and pulled up the wrong web of associations in your brain. However, it is time to declare an end to the battle between gut and mind and to the belief that intuitions are parapsychological fluff. It would be better to explore how the internalized experiences from which gut feelings arise best interact with the deliberate calculations of the conscious mind. A University of London team found that people who went with their initial response on a test of visual perception, and questions included picking out an anomaly in pattern of symbols, did better than those who were given more time to ponder. Whereas the subconscious mind recognized a rotated version of the same symbol as different, the conscious mind reasoned that an apple is still an apple, whether rotated or not, the researchers concluded. When the subjects had time to engage their higher level functions instead of relying on their intuitive responses, they were more likely to be wrong. Give me a second to have a sip of water. My throat is running dry. So, that's better. Let's carry on. Another example Malcolm Gladwell describes in his excellent book Blink. 1983, an art dealer approached the Getty Museum in California, wanting to sell them a perfectly preserved marble statue from the 6th century BC at the price of a cool $10 million. The Getty Museum was very cautious. They took the statue on loan in order to research it very, very carefully. I'm cutting a very long story very short here. After 14 months of intensive research, they agreed to buy. The New York Times marked the occasion with a front-page article. The art journal, the Burlington Magazine, wrote a long and glowing account of the statue. Everyone was happy. Later, four different experts visiting the Getty separately and viewing the sculpture immediately saw it was a fake. Without being able to tell why they felt that way, they all had a hunch, a gut feeling, an intuition, but no explanation to back it up. In the end, it turned out that they were right. The statue was a fake. How on earth was this possible? My explanation of it is that the Getty experts probably wanted the sculpture to be genuine, which may have led them to some kind of cherry-picking, seeing only the supporting evidence and ignoring signs to the contrary. This did not happen because they wanted it to happen, but they were searching the conscious mind for evidence that the statue was indeed genuine, and they used a higher-level function in this search. Remember my talk quite a few weeks ago about the thinker and the prover who are part of your mind. The thinker can think whatever you like, and the prover will find reasons that the thinker is right. If you think that you are an idiot, the prover will find evidence to support your claim. If you think that you are brilliant, the prover will find evidence to support this claim. The outside experts came to the Getty full of curiosity and surely also with an open mind. Their intuition kicked in immediately when seeing the sculpture, before they had the time to consider the higher level function, their expertise, their knowledge. They didn't even know what it was they found disturbing. They reacted on a hunch that something was wrong, and their hunch was right. Remember what I told you last week. Some program in their subconscious mind might have triggered doubt, but there was nothing in the subconscious to provide evidence for this doubt. So the experience could have gone right into the unconscious to find a program there to help them along. There might have been something that associated the new experience with something that they experienced before, and doubt increased. Yet, still not knowing what exactly was wrong with the sculpture. But the doubt of these experts was strong enough for the Getty to look at it again. And then they found hard evidence that the sculpture indeed was a fake. However, it needed experts to have this hunch. You or I could not have had this intuition, unless, of course, you happen to be an expert in ancient Greek sculptures. This means that the more you know about something, the easier it is for you to develop gut feelings about it. Because your gut feeling, your intuition, your hunches, they are all based on knowledge or on experience stored in your subconscious or deep-seated in your unconscious mind. Can you always trust your intuition? Only when you can differentiate between intuition and wishful thinking. And that's not easy to do. A very simple explanation is that if you want a particular outcome and you focus on achieving this outcome and you need to make a decision to achieve it, the likelihood is that your decision-making processes are not based on intuition but on wishful thinking. In other words, decision-making processes or thought processes cannot trigger intuition. Thought and intuition do not go hand in hand. Intuition is thoughtless. The act of reflecting on intuition is precisely what intuition is not. Intuition is really your sub or unconscious on autopilot, performing its actions of processing information outside of your awareness. It is non-conscious thinking. Non-conscious processes operate all the time in complex decision-making. Oftentimes, we just don't give them credit. Often we cite rational-sounding criteria for our feelings and actions and do not disclose the subjective preferences or feelings that arise spontaneously. As I mentioned in my introduction to this theme, there are also esoteric explanations to intuition that are based in religion or spirituality. They propose that intuition is divine guidance, your psychic messenger or your guardian angel. They even propose that intuition is evidence for a higher power. I do not want to go into it because it is not something I believe in it, on the one hand, but on the other hand, I cannot disprove it either. Another quick reminder that I'm live on air and ready to take your calls with questions and comments, as long as they concern the subject I'm talking about. Otherwise, go to my website, mindmattersonline.info, and mindmattersonline is one word, and then you can send me an email. Write to me and I will reply as usual within 48 hours. Let us move on to something else. For those of you who are serious in your want to control your minds, to take charge of your lives, there is one attribute essential for you: resilience. In life, things often do not go as you want them to go. For various reasons, your plans do not pan out, your visions do not become reality, your investments do not increase in value, your relationships are not as loving and supporting as you want, and your career plans experience setbacks. And what about some of the bigger problems that set us back? divorce, bankruptcy, health crisis, robbed, attacked. Now what? What is your attitude when you experience one or more setbacks in life? What state of mind does it trigger in you? What coping and mastering skills are you able to access when you have been knocked down? These questions explore your level of resilience, your strategy for bouncing back when you suffer a setback and get knocked down. Setbacks do happen, and setbacks are pretty democratic. They happen to all people of all ages, all races, all religions, or economic status. They happen to everyone. And in the last years, with the worldwide economy going pear-shaped, lots of people have suffered economic, personal, and relational setbacks. My psychotherapy practice constantly brought me into the presence of people who were in the throes of setbacks, and I was amazed at how some of them had such a spirit of resilience. Nothing was going to keep them down. No matter how traumatic the experience, they were going to get up again, and they were going to come back, and they did. All they wanted from my therapy to develop the self-awareness and the resourcefulness to make that comeback. But of course, the majority was not like that. Sometimes I saw people in therapy who were down and they were behaving as if they were out. With their setback, they were down and they were staying down for the count. They seemed to have the life sucked out of them and to be without any bounds inside for coming back. And it was not the degree of or severity of the setback. That was not the determining factor. What makes a difference between someone who gets knocked down and then gets up with an attitude of determination, persistence, and optimism from the person who just lies there like a zombie? What makes a difference between the person who thinks, feels, talks, and acts like a victim of life's fate and the person who thinks, feels, talks, and acts like the architect of his or her life? Resilience is not a regular kind of state of mind. It is not a state that you can access like a feeling or a thought, like the feeling of confidence, for example. Just step into it, amplify it, and there you have it. You are confident. Resilience and some other states of mind are so complex and so systemic that they do not operate as a primary state that you can easily access and amplify it and apply it. These states involve higher levels of thoughts and feelings. That's what I discovered about resilience. To create this state, you not only have to have a basic core sense that whatever happens, it is just something to deal with. You have to have empowering beliefs about yourself as a person, your value and worth as a person. You have to have the ability to learn and develop skills to cope with things, your self-confidence. You want to have relationships with others who you can depend and trust in the process. You need your determination and persistence that over time you will recover and bounce back and be as strong as ever before. You need meanings and intentions that keep you inspired, hopeful, and optimistic. And you need your sense of self-efficacy that you can take proactive initiative to turn things around again. That's quite a lot, isn't it? That requires layer upon layer of resourceful states about your resourceful states. And it is systemic, each resourceful state or frame influencing the others so that synergy, something more than the sum of the parts, emerge. And that emergent state of resilience is a state that takes the bad thing out of the setback that happens and keeps it out from oneself so that it's not personal. It keeps it out from one's whole life so that it's not pervasive, and keeps it out from one's sense of time, so that it's not permanent. As always, it is how you interpret a setback. That is the key. if you take the bad thing and interpret it with the following three P's, you experience learned helplessness. If you interpret the bad thing using the three T's, you experience learned optimism. The three P's are: it is personal, it is about me. It is pervasive, it is everywhere. It is permanent, it will last forever. Quite pessimistic, wouldn't you say? And this leads to learned helplessness. The three T's are: it is that, an event, a situation, it's not me. It is there, in that space and place, not everywhere. It is then, at that time, not forever. It is quite different to the three P's, and it leads to learned optimism. The way to create non-resilience is to think in P terms all the time. You interpret any setback as personal, pervasive, and permanent. That's quite a spirit dampener, isn't it? The cure that leads to resilience is to tee off on the setback, that is, interpret it as that, there, then. These are the three magic words that keeps the evil outside of you and your matrix of frames, that, there, then. Or if it's happening at this moment, this, here, and now. Remember when I mentioned choice points? You are at your choice point now. What will you do? Do you go for the P's or for the T's? It is entirely your choice. No one can force you to interpret a setback back or anything else in a particular way. Yet how you interpret it and the meanings that you give determine the experiences you have and the quality of your life. This brings me to the end. Unfortunately, I get the signal that I have to finish my show. I will continue. I will finish the resilience chapter in my next show. But for now, I need to end the show. As I said, next week I will continue, I will finish the theme, and then, provided that I'm not talking too long on this subject, I will change to something else. Thank you for listening. Please go to my website, mindmattersonline.info, to find my email address and to contact me with your thoughts and questions. Mind Matters Online is one word. I will reply within 48 hours. Let me also tell you that communicating with you directly is very important for me. I really want to know what you think about this show. I would like to hear your comments and suggestions, but also your problems. For now, I leave you with wise words by Albert Einstein, and I quote, "In the middle of difficulty lies opportunity," unquote. Thank you again for listening. Tune in again next week. Same day, same time. Goodbye.